This episode and all of our Sundance coverage is brought to you by DaVinci Resolve and the Ursa Mini Pro from Blackmagic Design, and the all-new VideoMic Pro Plus from Rode Microphones, the ultimate on-camera shotgun microphone. Hi, everybody. This is Liz Nord, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. There were four powerhouse cinematographers who had nine projects between them at Sundance this year. And somehow, despite their busy schedules, I was able to sit down with all four of them on the first day of the festival. Shauna Hagen, Claudia Roschke, Ashley Connor, and Mia Cioffi-Henry have a pretty amazing combined filmography. At Sundance alone, they screened docs, narratives, shorts, and an episodic TV show. What's also cool about this group is that they represent four different decades of DPs, having begun shooting professionally in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and 2010s respectively, so they were able to share stories and advice with each other that we can all benefit from. In our wide-ranging conversation, the talented group discusses the benefits of switching between docs and features instead of sticking to just one, how to be the cinematographer your director needs, why cinematography is a people's business, and much more. I think that this conversation will be especially useful to directors and DPs, but any movie lover will enjoy hearing about how the images on screen come together. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
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 Welcome. I'm so, so happy that you're all here at Sundance with me. Oh, my God. I'd love to have everyone just introduce yourselves and the films that or projects that you're here with first.
I'm Ashley Connor. I'm here with two films, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, directed by Desiree Akhavan, and Madeline's Madeline, directed by Josephine Decker.
My name is Claudia Raschke. I'm the DP of RBG, which is a feature documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I'm also here with The Price for Everything, which is directed by Nathaniel Kahn. And they're both feature docs.
I'm Shauna Hagen. I'm actually here with four projects, which is a record for me. the first one is Generation Wealth, directed by Lauren Greenfield. Another one is Lenny. It's an HBO pilot, a nonfiction series pilot, EP'd by Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor. Our director on our short that I did DP'd was Christine Turner. The third project is Inventing Tomorrow. I was a co-DP. Martina Rodwan, another amazing cinematographer, was the main DP, and I was a co-DP on a Mexico unit. On that one. And then the fourth one is Mr. Rogers, which I just saw, Won't You Be My Neighbor. So I had some additional photography on that as well. So it's great to be here. Thank you.
Hi. Sorry. I'm Mia Cioffi-Henry, and I've already lost my voice at Sundance. I'm here with just one project, a short film called Cheer Up Baby, directed by Adina Danziger.
To Shauna's point, you know, several of you have several projects in the festival, and Mia obviously also has several projects just juggling. So first question is just really practical. How do you find your gigs and how do you juggle them? How do you manage your time, your professional time?
I don't do it well. I mean, I somehow make it through the year, but I don't know. Time management seems to be like the most difficult aspect to our jobs. I feel like this year I worked from straight from like April to mid-December and was taking a break, and now I'm might not be. I don't know.
I find my work, most of my work is in documentaries. And so a lot of times Sundance is a fantastic opportunity for people to see my work. And also when I'm here, I get a chance to network with the people who, say for Nathaniel Kahn, Price of Everything, which is fantastic, great work in that. And I met Nathaniel a couple weeks ago and then saw him again today, but it's just sort of, and I've never worked with him, but it was a great opportunity for me to network with new people. But time management is certainly a challenge, but I think I love the quote that if you want something done, ask a busy woman, because it's like exactly, I feel like I'm more productive when I'm busy. And so I try to keep, sort of keep busy with lots of projects. I think it's a challenge, but it's also exciting to be involved with so many different projects. And I think with so many projects here at the festival, it's also time management is massively important. Just also personal, like making sure you take care of yourself first. But I don't know, it's just, it's how I find my job certainly is just, again, networking. People see my work. I also, if I have a particular director I like to work with, I, you know, find a way to kind of meet that person either at a screening at Sundance or some other way. But I don't know. I feel like I'm babbling. And I know that, like, sometimes that, like, us as DPs, I think that one of the reasons we're behind the camera is that often we don't like to talk about our work and ourselves, but it's an interesting exercise in trying to articulate what we do and why we do it. But anyway, thanks for having me. So,
well, we're, you know, you're visual people.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things I love about being part of No Film School is that we get to talk to DPs and talk to the folks who don't always get the interview. And you have so much insight into how this work actually gets made. So
I think it's a lot of putting words to things that we do just on a day-to-day basis that we don't even know are really part of, like, a specific part of being a DP. For me, how I get work is really word of mouth, through friends, through past collaborators, a little bit through, I went to grad film school, and so some connections through that, but mostly just either people see projects that I've shot and they ask the person who directed it, or they kind of see it on their own online, on nobudge.com, on Vimeo, on whatever, and kind of reach out from there. But I'm actually not as busy as I would love to be, because I'm very picky with the projects that I choose right now. I have a 1.5-year-old daughter, so I kind of time management is a whole new game in that regard. I know you know about that.
Yeah, I sure do. I have 2 kids, but they are older teenagers now, so I've been in the business since 84, which is a long time. And I did feature films for 10 years and switched over to feature documentaries and TV dramas. And ultimately, you know, your work is what is your best calling card. And for me, time management is really divided up between family, the things I'd like to do. I also invent games. So I have a whole,
like,
different...
digital games?
No, they're actually board games. Because
hell yes.
That's really cool. You want to tell us about one of these?
I'm coming over
later.
That's going to be a whole other episode now. I'm writing it down.
I personally really, you know, the having kids and managing my time, being away very often, taught me that when I have the time to be home with my kids, that I really needed to make them special. So with that came a lot of board games and activities where I was really involved. And I find board games brings out your personality. It is a bonding time. And so that's got me very interested. But in terms of how I get work, it is really, for a long time, I had an agent that represented me while I was in the feature film industry. And then when I went into feature docs, it shifted. And it was really very apparent that it is a people's business. And you don't really get a job unless somebody trustworthy will recommend you. And so it is in everybody's interest to go to social gatherings, events, as you said, you know, film festivals, be at a screening, be involved. And that is how you kind of, you know, connect.
I'm curious, actually, this wasn't the original direction I was going to go, but now I know that Ashley goes between various, you know, types of platforms. Shauna has TV and film here. I mean, you all do that. And then you really, Claudia, made a very conscious switch from feature to doc. So talk about that a little bit. I want to start with you and hear why you made that choice.
Well, I was working for Miramax.
Ooh.
whole other podcast.
No, but kidding aside, so here was my story. I was on a complete track on just doing feature films, and I when you do a feature film, I was flying around, being in remote locations 4 months at a time, and you know, you kind of come home and you crash. And you know, I fell in love. We wanted kids, and then the question is, how do you manage your time at that point? And it became very clear to me that I can certainly go on doing feature films, but then I have to have a full-time nanny, because my husband was also, you know, working full-time. And I really, it didn't sit right with me, because it was really something I wanted. I wanted to be present, and so I just decided to switch and do only East Coast features and focus on feature documentaries. So often what happens now is that I have 3 projects simultaneously that work, because feature documentaries don't get their funding in one batch. And so you basically have a project to work on intermittently. And so it carries you through, you know, in a different way. And I can be with my kids when they need it. Mm-hmm. And when I wanted to.
Mia, what about you? Do you travel between the various platforms?
I do. Right now, I haven't shot a feature yet, and I'm hoping that's going to happen this year. I've got a couple things sort of percolating. But I'm mostly working in shorts, music videos, and the commercial worlds, and actually some doc work as well. But it's really, I'm much more interested in a script at the moment. Very interested in breaking down a script and getting to the psychological understanding of characters and moments and planning out beats and all of that. That's like what really thrills me about this job, is sort of the analytical aspect of it, taking words and translating them visually. So I'm trying to stay more in the narrative world than anything else. And I don't know, just I feel like I'm kind of taking it moment by moment. I like getting deep into something rather than bouncing around too much.
Yeah. I think for me, it's kind of I do docs. I've done a three features. I've done a fair amount of commercials, done episodic television. I've done branded content, pretty much everything, right? I feel like each of these projects, they're all storytelling. They're all forms of storytelling. So I feel like what I can bring to the table, each job like teaches me a different way to tell a story. So a feature, you approach it one way, a doc, you approach it another way, a commercial, you certainly approach it a completely different way. But learning something, say how to think on my feet, I've also done reality television, so I'm not sort of proud of it, but that said, and looking in hindsight, it taught me how to think on my feet. And also think alone. Often you're out there. I did Survivor. I was four seasons on Survivor.
Holy and moly.
Basically you're with
so much to ask you about that. Oh my God.
But for a while I was really kind of nervous or uninterested in kind of saying out loud that I worked on Survivor, because reality television has such a bad sort of reputation. But honestly, looking in hindsight, I learned to think on my feet, and also often we're out there without producers and without directors, so you're kind of trying to tell the story visually without really much influence, and you're just, you know, what I do and what I feel like I do best in my documentary work is pure observational verite. Mm-hmm. So being kind of, there, kind of just following the story, listening, paying attention to, you know, emotionally responding to a scene, all that stuff is, so what I learned from reality television, I can apply in a documentary world, or what I learn on a commercial, I might be able to. So each discipline kind of can inform my work on other disciplines, if that makes sense. So I can take stuff that I learned doing a feature and bring, you know, vice versa. Also, as in a literal example too, in a doc environment, you know, sometimes you go into a situation where you can't light a scene, but you find this beautiful shaft of light that creates this sort of evokes this mood that then on a feature you want to kind of recreate that. So only in the documentary environment that you've observed that, then can you, you know, kind of feel the mood that light evokes, and then you kind of then can say in your next doc you have this great feature that you have an opportunity to kind of recreate that. So one informs the other. So I like mixing it up. I mean, I do, my heart is with documentaries. I feel like I'm sort of a sensitive being, and I enjoy the being engaged on a level with documentaries that the other projects don't. I don't really feel engaged. That said, I enjoy everything. I love the work. So,
well, I actually wanted to just refer to what you were saying in terms of the difference between feature films and documentaries, because it's quite amazing of how it shifts. You know, during my time doing feature films, all the sculpting of the light and the choreography with the camera and the shot listing and, you know, serving the story with visuals to support the subtext, all of that work, that training, you know, when you go then and take that into the documentary, it you all of a sudden feel like, oh my God, you know, I really don't need to light. Because look, if I'm positioning myself in this sweet spot in this location, oh my God, it is the lighting ratio is beautiful, yeah. You know, and the art then becomes the choice of your exposure, of how you set your iris, you know, and how do you take advantage of what's given, and you know it does a different kind of brain gymnastics that really is very fulfilling, and I find that the one thing that feature films which is, you know, wonderful to do because you do lighting, you know, and you have the control, the creative control. But with documentaries, it's all the spontaneity and connecting to your character and floating organically when you're doing verite. And when you're doing verite, the decisions are, you know, split-second decisions because you have to be understanding the story, get yourself in the right position, and capture it, you know, in an authentic way. And that is a whole different challenge that I can't carry into feature films. That is something that is missing because it is created. However, doing feature films, you know, you have your palette of different tools where you paint with light, where you do, you know, extraordinary moves and frames.
Don't you feel a little bit that knowing those things, knowing how to capture that, and look for those things on an emotional level helps you kind of recreate those things out as well on an emotional level? I mean, I know that you haven't sort of gone back to feature work since working in documentary much, but that sort of understanding of it, the more you know, the more you can do, and the more you can do, the more you know. You know what I mean?
Well, it certainly feeds each other, but, you know, I'm doing this documentary called The Bit Player right now, and it's about a gentleman who's a mathematician who passed away at the beginning of 2003, and he was this genius, and there's no video archival footage of him. Mm. Now, how do you tell a story when you have a man and his life, and what are you going to do? So, of course, there are recreations. And so my feature knowledge, I did recreation of the 1920s, of the 1940s in black and white and in noir style, and the 1980s in terms of, you know, the 80s, VHS 16 look. Millimeter, mm. you know, look in terms of, you know, the color rendition and so
Part
it is, yeah, yeah exactly. It's a, then that comes, all that feature knowledge comes mm-hmm. back in, you know.
So there's a conversation between the work. I mean, it makes sense. Ashley, we haven't forgotten you.
I just feel like similar adjectives that you use to describe your doc work is how I would define my narrative work. And I think I do work from an emotional level. I do work from instinct. I do, and, you know, on lower budget independent films, you don't really have all the time in the world to like sculpt and shape every single piece of light because you have to make your day. So I think it is, and I think, you know, I get asked to do docs a lot, but like time wise, it never really functions for me because I usually have another project lined up. So it's like, you know, I got asked for a Netflix doc series and it was like, we need you 4 days a month for the next 6 months. And I was like, absolutely not. Like, I can't do that.
I would take that job.
Yeah. but at the end of the day, I think what we're all talking about is artistic practice. And I think what maybe defines a lot of our work is kind of the emotional subtext that we feel when we're with a camera and holding a camera and speaking with a subject, whether it be artificial script-wise or in a doc setting. I think the way I respond to actors is through some sense of reality and kind of, you know, basing my work around that tenet. And it's not always that way, but that's what gets me off the most, I guess.
And it's a good place to start, too, for any scene, whether it's super stylized or it's very naturalistic, to just like start from the truthful emotion of the scene, of the moment, and then go from there.
So we're talking about the style of work, but what about directors? Are there qualities that you look for in a director that you want to partner with, and or like a specific way you like to collaborate with directors?
I mean, for me, I like a director who can make a decision, and sometimes that's just a director who needs to learn how to say no, or what they don't like is as important as what they do like. And, you know, because directing, you're just answering questions all day, and you're trying to, like, keep the heart of the film alive and, like, keep that heartbeat going steady. But like, if you can't make a decision, everything fades away. So that's kind of what I look for in a director. And then, you know, whether or not, if they're more visually conscious, that's great. But if they're not, I feel like I can kind of step up more in that regard. But yeah, and I don't know. I don't really mind somebody who yells. I don't mind whatever. I'm pretty like tough in that regards. I don't think that people should, but you know, as long as the work's good and what you're making at the end of the day, you guys can kind of like pat each other on the back and walk out and think that like you were both working towards the same goal.
I think for me, right, bouncing off of your, communication is a key. I mean, just, you know, most of my doc work, we're constantly communicating about story, about character, about, you know, we're constantly kind of, I often try to watch dailies with a director at night. Sometimes it's not possible, but we try to find out what's working, what's not working, what stories resonated most or what character beats, whatever. But I also think in my documentary work, I think it might be a little bit different in the feature environment, but in the documentaries, I appreciate a director that's patient. My Verite work, I've worked with so many directors who are very impatient and they're going after like the shiny objects, I always call it. You know, they want to shoot this, they want to shoot that, they want to shoot this. Oh, that's happening, let's go do that. And we never really have the sort of ability to shoot a beginning, middle, and an end of a story. And so sometimes if they're always following the shiny objects, it's a little challenging to kind of flesh out a story completely. I enjoy directors that can kind of tell me what they want, and to your point, kind of be very clear about what they want. In a documentary environment, sometimes that's not possible, but at least you can talk about the ideas that you want. Or say, for example, you know, this character's they just had a fight. These two people are married. They having some marital problems. They just had a big fight. Let's try to visualize that. This is a scene of them making dinner. Then that's a real life experience. A gentleman I've worked with, Michael Apted, is an amazing director. And he said, look, we you know, we're doing a day in the life of a married couple. And he gave me the sort of information without telling me what to do. But he said, they've had a fight. We want to try to visualize that in any way. They're cooking dinner, which is sort of seemingly mundane. But he was chopping the carrots with such kind of... he was frustrated, and so I got a lot of cutaways of the visual. You know, she's slamming the plates down on, you know, as she's setting the table, and he's chopping. You know, sort of visualizing the anger and the sort of tension in the scene without them speaking about it. But anyway, I also like when directors can just kind of let things happen. I think in a documentary environment, sometimes that can be very unnerving to just be there and kind of be patient. But I think that's where the gold is directors can trust their shooters, when the subjects can trust the director. I mean, I don't know, I'm getting off key or off track, but I feel like it's about trust, it's about communication, it's about patience. It's just also about knowing what your story is. I mean, in a feature environment, that's the same. In a doc, what's the story? What's the story we're telling? And also being on the same team, yeah. Having somebody, I'd like a director who will advocate for you, but also sort of realize you're definitely both on the same team.
There's so many things. There's a wish list can be so long for a director in our minds, but every directing collaboration and DP collaboration is kind of unique in its own way. For me, I think what I really love in a director is somebody who can get the whole team on board behind their singular vision. Mm. You know, when I'm asked to do things that are kind of beyond my capabilities in terms of time or equipment or they want something that looks higher budget than it is, whatever it is, if I feel like I'm in good hands with their vision, I feel like if the crew feels like they're in good hands with their vision, then everybody's working towards the same goal. I think it's easier said than done to kind of get everybody marching in the same direction on a film set. And to me, a good director is somebody who's got a vision. Doesn't have to be visual, but it has to be some sort of direction that we're all moving towards, and I really look for that in a collaboration.
I totally agree. You just completely nailed it.
Yes.
The thing that kind of stands out to me in terms of looking back, in terms of the films that I shot and the experiences that I had with directors, there are some really... some circumstances where you're working really, really hard and everybody thinks that they are on the same path. And then you feel all of a sudden a lack of respect. It just starts happening. It starts happening with the crew. All of a sudden there is a judgment that's present and we are not making the days, and all of a sudden there's this wavering on the director, and it affects the entire mood. And when this respect for the director drops, then you know you're in trouble. And, you know, I always look out for that. It's like, what is happening here? What's the pulse overall? You know, where is the expectation? Are we really, as you said, all going in, along the same path and working for the same goal? And does he really have, or she really have a vision and overarching vision of what the film will be? Because, look, the fact is that when you're on set, things change. Mm-hmm. You can have a script, you can have it storyboarded, you can have a schedule, and your AD knows the shot list for each particular scene. But then there is freeform. The actors think that it doesn't work that way, and they should try something else, and all of a sudden you're in a debate, and then you're losing time, and then you have to make up for the time, and which scene are you going to cut? And all of a sudden everything shifts. And to be prepared for that shift, then you have to have a true leader who knows what is essential in order to tell the story and where to, you know, alter the course. And that's what I look for in a director, somebody who has a firm, you know, grasp of what happens if it doesn't work out. You know, what is, you know, the ultimate goal? And for feature films, the same as it is for documentaries, because in documentaries you have a subject and you're shadowing a character for a while and all of a sudden it runs flat.
It life
happens. Doesn't develop. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It doesn't develop, you know, and so you need that kind of vision in a director.
I think in that same vein too, as the DP, you're really you have to be 100% behind the director in a lot of ways, and kind of the surrogate of the director's vision, and be able to communicate that to your crew. And if you start to waver yourself on trusting them at any given moment, you can also lose your crew very easily, because they don't feel then in good hands, and then their work is not kind of moving in the same direction.
I want to believe that we're kind of beyond some sense of like a tour theory that, you know, the director is like the all leading person. And I think, especially on my more recent collaborations, what's so exciting is when the director turns and says, I don't know. And if it is a collaboration, then it is being like, let's talk about this. And it is developing like different kinds of sets where like people like, if I have a question, sometimes I'll turn to my AC and be like, dude, does this look like garbage? Or like, is it just me? You know, like you want to, but like, I feel like you have to be capable of questioning the director and making sure that like, because sometimes directors can like go off on tangents and not quite see like, and that's what pre-production does. It's like you get on the same page so that hopefully you don't have those questions. But if you feel like they're kind of wavering, then you're capable of like helping them write the course.
I think that's definitely true. And I think that knowing the script, knowing the story, knowing the characters, knowing whatever it is, the angles that you want to tell the story, like as good as the director, knowing it that deeply, that when they do begin to question themselves, like being able to back them up is important. But I kind of prescribe to that, like, the director is the one in charge, because like everybody needs to believe in a single vision, because too many cooks.
Well, let me ask you this then. If that mood, you know, starts to creep, as Claudia, you know, eloquently described it, if you start to feel those tingles on a set, like, maybe this is like starting to lose people. So a lot of our listeners are young, up and coming directors. What would you advise a young, you know, or any director to do if they're starting to feel like they're losing their crew a little bit? What are some tactics for reining it all back in, getting the confidence back up?
As a DP, or you mean?
What can the director do, like from the perspective of a DP who manages the rest of the crew?
I mean, it's hard because low budget, because we have the capability of making films at such a low budget, it means that people who might not be ready to direct a film get to direct a film. Mm-hmm. And so I work with a lot of first-time directors, and a lot of my job is to like help them and like bring them to get their power back. But sometimes the power is not always there. So it is about empowering them. It is about like bring them back. And I think when directors start to lose the crew, you know, yeah, like taking a step back, even like taking a half day off and just kind of like reorienting or something, or like doing something to like kind of build group morale up again, because making films is hard and there's a lot of sensitive emotional people on set, as there should be, but like feelings are involved, so you know, you just have to like know how to kind of right the ship when it's going off course.
And it is tricky because, you know, it can originate from an actor that they've been cast, and then you find out it's a miscast. Yeah. What do you do with an actor that doesn't perform, that overacts, that, you know, that's a very hard situation to be in, because the script is written, especially in feature films. I think that the advice that I would give to any, director is at the point when they feel that they are not sure, that uncertainty enters their playing field, that they look at their cinematographer and their producer as a collaborator on equal footing, and say, like, look, I am unsure because X, Y, and Z has happened. You know, do you have any ideas? Can we figure something out? And then, or if that's one scenario, the other one would be, if I sense that the director that I'm working with is unsure, that I will, and it's losing their ground and going off on a tangent, as you were saying, then at that moment, I try to pick what I think is the right and the golden moment. And I said, like, wow, this moment was really great. And try to remind them of what we were after, so that they themselves can come to the realization, oh my God, I'm off course. Because you can't really say to a director, hey, buddy, you're off course. You know, you have to have a very good, trusting relationship in order to be that frank. And a director does not want to lose face. And so you have to have that, awareness that how you're presenting something is guiding somebody so that ultimately they find their way back.
Or if a script is involved or like an idea for a doc, then it's really about being like, hold on, you wrote this. Let's talk about why you wrote this before we like throw it away, or like, what's the beat? What's the heart of the scene? You know, like just kind of asking them questions, because they'll usually, yeah, I find that asking directors questions to like engage them and like bring them back to what it is when they wrote it is like usually
exactly
a good place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I like to kind of play the exercise, if we could only do this scene in one shot, where would we put the camera? And that usually kind of resets the brain and says, okay, what is the most important thing? Where would we put the camera if we were getting kicked out of this location after this one take? And I think that that's kind of a good, or I call it like wish list shot listing, where you say, if we only have three more shots in this place, what are the most important things that you need to get this in the edit and tell this story? And then anything else on top of that, that's just gravy. And we love gravy, but let's get this right. And then like release ourselves from that sort of tension.
No, I was going to say, sort of bounce off all of what everybody else is saying. I mean, in the documentary environment, a lot of times directors are either shut out of a location, or an interview setup doesn't happen, or there's something that, you know, that fails, or that we, you know,
someone doesn't want you
something
there.
Doesn't want us there. So then I'm often like, you kind of have to be their cheerleader and say, you know, hey, here's what we can do. Okay, we can't do that, but here's a few options of what we can do. Hey, we can go shoot B-roll. We can any other options. Or, hey, what if we turn around? You know, maybe we, if that didn't really work because we didn't notice that on the scout, or luckily rare to have a scout on a documentary. But in any case, if a location or something doesn't work out, I often try to provide them with some real opportunities for, or real possibilities for like other things we can do. Trying to stay positive, you know, trying to stay as uplifting and positive as possible. I mean, I think, the feature directors, I think, I don't know, features and docs are sort of different, but also very similar. But again, in the documentary environment, if things aren't really going that well, I think it's just about what we do have versus what we don't have and what we have gotten. It's kind of all, at least in the doc environment, a lot of times people lament what we don't get. Like, oh, we missed that. Oh, we missed that shot. Oh, we didn't. But sometimes we have the old saying, I'm sure Claudia knows it too, if we didn't shoot it, it actually didn't happen. I mean, you know, we can't prove that it happened. So, but trying to stay positive and trying to stay, you know, think about the things we do have and rather than the things we don't have. And knowing that things often get repeated. There's often opportunities, even if something is only, quote, happening once. There's always ways to tell a story, you know, like you're the one you're doing now. If there's no actual footage, you're recreating it and doing a creative way of telling a story. And, you know, often sometimes in this sort of seemingly like sort of temporary failure or temporary kind of distraction, you can discover new ways of doing things that might be better than your original plan. So that's always kind of exciting to kind of come up with new ideas of kind of tackling a challenge that comes your way. So
I feel like that sort of circles back to our talk about traveling between doc and feature too, because I come from the doc world and I have worked only on a couple narrative things, and I found that having that doc experience allowed me to be so much more flexible on set. Like, I knew how to pivot because of being a doc person in a way that the narrative folks like were freaking out about.
Right.
You know, it's interesting.
Girl, I can pivot.
And it's also because, you know, look, the feature industry or the feature film sets are hierarchical. It's very military.
Right.
It is, everybody has a very specific job. Whereas in documentaries, everybody does everything.
Oh, please. You know, the producer is holding the boom. Like, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Or even shooting second camera, or the director is shooting while you're shooting. You know, it's like it's all a true, you know, effort to make it happen.
Originally designed for Hollywood's elite colorists, DaVinci Resolve has been used on more feature films and TV shows than anything else because it lets you create images that are simply impossible with other tools. The latest release of Resolve now incorporates full nonlinear editor functionality and fully featured Fairlight audio, integrated directly with color tools to provide a comprehensive and complete pipeline for finishing. Recently introduced and making an impact around the industry for its high quality and flexible form factor, the Ursa Mini Pro professional digital cinema camera combines incredible image quality with the features of a traditional broadcast camera. Ergonomically designed, controls on the side of the camera allow you to adjust most settings by feel and without ever having to take your eyes off the action. Ursa Mini Pro also features built-in ND filters, a status display, and a revolutionary new interchangeable lens mount that lets you change between EF photographic lenses or PL, B4, and F mount lenses. Ursa Mini Pro is lightweight and comfortable enough to use all day, has controls that are extremely fast to use, and image quality that's far superior to broadcast cameras costing 10 times more. That's the Ursa Mini Pro Professional Digital Cinema Camera from Blackmagic Design. The all-new VideoMic Pro Plus from Rode Microphones is jam-packed with useful features for shooters on the go. The automatic power function is perfect for the run-and-gun shooter, automatically turning the microphone off when unplugged from the camera. The mic's built-in battery door makes replacing the battery a breeze, plus it won't get lost. It has multiple power options, including the all-new Rode LB1 lithium-ion rechargeable battery, two AA batteries, or powering continuously via micro USB. The VideoMic Pro Plus also offers digital switching, which ensures that you have ultimate capture of the audio signal at the source, reducing post-production and editing times. Finally, the High Frequency Boost will boost high frequencies, enhancing detail and clarity in the recording, and there's a safety channel that helps ensure the signal does not clip when unexpected spikes occur. That's the all-new VideoMic Pro Plus from Rode Microphones.
You've each referenced this kind of director's vision idea, and I'm always curious about the conversations that happen, like how directors might tell you what they're thinking, and then how, and then you're like left with this thing that you have to execute. And we could talk about that all day. So I'd love to stick to the films that you have here, maybe one or both, or, you know, were there any particularly sort of interesting challenges put before you as a DP for these projects that you then got to wrestle with, and how did you figure it out?
So Lenny, this series of documentary shorts, the one that I did is called Dead is Better, directed by Christine Turner. And we're, the subject of the film is a woman, a writer, performer. She has a lot of spoken word. She's obsessed with death. And she's a writer and does her research. She does these things where she writes letters to dead people, mainly dead celebrities. So, dear River Phoenix, I never knew you, but if we were in high school together, we probably would have dated, yada yada. So, it's interesting and it's fascinating work and really, really amazing. But the challenge of telling a story about a writer who does a lot of sort of internal, like, you know, she's sitting on the computer doing research, internet research. How do you make that visually exciting to hold a, you know, we'd never really want wanted to, the idea of it was to do maybe a 5 to 7 minute short. So we knew we didn't have to have a lot of footage, but how much footage can you have of a woman on a computer in 8 different positions in her home, on a bed and a desk and whatever. It's like, so we ended up, you know, Christine and I sort of brainstormed and did a lot of the particular case that she's, without revealing the details, you'll have to go see Dead is Better or watch Lenny on HBO. We did a lot of, we encouraged her to certainly go out and do a lot of research out in the field. So we did a lot of really creative B-roll of her kind of walking around and in a graveyard and all stuff that's very specific to the story that she's researching. So, but that was a real challenge to kind of try to visualize somebody who does something very internal, an artist at work. I don't know. So that was a challenge, certainly, with Lenny.
And how did you overcome it?
We ended up shooting tons of B-roll of her, in the... we found lots of interesting and unique ways to, specifically with different B-roll setups. So, we had maybe 5 or 6 different locations. We actually only shot on 3 days, one of which was mostly her interview and a lot of her on the computer in the house where she grew up. She was investigating a crime that happened in the neighboring town where she grew up. So we were able to get a ton of B-roll, her just sort of doing her thing. But also what made it more authentic for us was her just literally doing, it was a departure for her that she was actually going and talking to people that knew the boy that was murdered. So, and it was unique to her because she hadn't done it before. So it sort of, there was a realness, a sort of authenticity about it that sort of made it. But initially when it was on paper, it was sort of like this woman's writing an article about, or writing a letter to a person she didn't know. And I don't know, on paper it was really challenging, but we found a way.
I think for the 2 films I have here, I kind of approach directors in similar ways. I'm like, give me everything. Give me what are you reading? What are you listening to? What are you watching? What did you watch recently that you hated? And sort of slowly start to like build a world around that. And with Desiree's movie, which is like a teenage girl gets sent to a gay conversion therapy camp. We set in the 90s, so we were looking at footage from the 90s. We were listening to a lot of 90s playlists. We were, looking at a lot of Instagram Today for, like, teenage girls. And then really it became about refining what it means to be in an institution. And so that was kind of, like, our goal there. It was, like, how to create an institutionalized teen story that kind of, like, breaks out. And also, like, would speak to somebody. The similar, I talked a lot about, like, virgin suicides, which, like, when I watched in high school, I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, got the poster, got the soundtrack, got the, got it all, and was, like, obsessed with it. So I was like, what about this can we, like, speak to younger girls or boys, anybody? And with Josephine's movie, Josephine works, like, quite abstractly, and... she sent me like a 50-page image list that had like images of space and just kind of anything that bounces around in Josephine's head. And that's what's so fun about working with her is like she's just this box of energy that like bursts out and anything that she thinks comes right out. And so it's really about like kind of refining her in a way and like being like, okay, I hear this, I hear that. Now, how do we make this a reality? For Josephine, it's really sort of like cracking into her brain and letting the light shine out. And it's like, how do you do that? And it's asking her a ton of questions and like whatever comes. Yeah, she's like, I want a 30-foot jib arm. And I was like, okay, well, then we're going to get a 30-foot jib arm and like making it happen for a dance number. I don't know. But yeah, so it kind of, I like to like take everything that they want to give me and sort of from that, listen to it and like add and shape.
Wow. For me, Cheer Up Baby, Adina and I, it was the first time we were working together and we had only really met over Skype.
And you
kind of had like, we internet dated our director DP relationship. and I, when we then did finally meet, it was mostly conversations about our own experiences. The film is about the aftermath of kind of a very abrupt sexual harassment situation on the subway. And it was a lot of talking about our own experiences. I think that was a very unique thing because we're both women living in New York City, or have been young women living in New York City. And so we talked about our own experiences and the psychology of that, and kind of where we were going. Another part of it was really, really low budget, small crew, limited access to our locations, no time to light, no lights. So we were really focusing on our lead India's face, her body language, how it changes over the period of the film. And that became kind of our visual canvas for that. Mm-hmm. And then with the sort of the color that we use in the film, I think that was the only visual references, I guess, that we really had beforehand. But it was very unusual from how I usually work, which is more image-based, just because I love paintings and photography and films and still lifes and whatever, sculptures. This was really verbal, which was an interesting way to get to know her.
Well, for the Ruth Bader Ginsburg feature doc, RBG, it's a lot of it is archival, and because, you know, her access is very limited. So the film is structured in such a way that a lot of her, in order to get close to her, you have to, like a queen, work from the outer circle into the inner circle.
Wow.
And so there was a lot of interviews of people who would describe things that she had done and how they know each other in reference to her, and build her character that way. And the challenge for me was that each person that we would interview, I wasn't sure of how relevant they would end up being in the film. And so there needs to be a certain, because it's an interview, it needs to be a certain setting that reflects, in terms of the location, who they are, as well as kind of fit into an overall vision. And look, she is 84. She doesn't like lights whatsoever.
Oh.
So we would have situation, and I knew that coming up, that if I would light her, she would complain, and then I would have to take the lights down. But I have been in situations like that, and I didn't want to get there. So I knew, because I have extensive lighting, you know, knowledge, that super soft sources, you know, double bounces will really work for her. It will not hurt her eyes. She has sensitive eyes, and I can understand it. But that meant that all the other interviews had to fall in line with it. And so going from location to location where you don't know yet what you're going to encounter, and making it look natural so that it's all fitting, that was the challenge.
Wow.
And I feel pretty happy about how that all worked together. She is amazing. She's my hero.
She is amazing. I also know the film. Julie Cohen is a friend and has been on the podcast, and I'm so excited to see the movie. Listeners love to geek out about tools, and every time I ask DPs, they say, well, it has to be the right tool for the job, you know, but I'm going to ask anyway, and you can't say it has to be the right tool for the job. I really want to know, what cameras and lenses do you just love to use?
I shot Desiree Camera Post on Alexa XT with Pancros, which I've used and liked a lot. Josephine's movie, I really kind of fell in love with the... We shot on a mirror with K35s, and they're kind of very interesting lenses with like optical aberrations, and I really wanted to like exploit their kind of difficulty and kind of use it to help with the overall like abstract nature of the film. And also on that, I kind of like to pull my own focus, and the throw of the lens is quite small. So it was easier to kind of like hop on board when I needed to. But the K35s, don't everybody go rent them, because the price just goes up. But
I love to shoot 16. Any film is always my, I think it's because that's how I learned when I was in undergrad. It was sort of what gave me the agency to become a DP in the first place, was shooting a Super 8 and regular 8 in undergrad and developing it in VATS myself. So I feel like I feel... very protective of that knowledge, and that being able to shoot on film has very much influenced how I work in digital, and I think that they're both valid, but yeah, I love to shoot on 35. I'm just going to say it.
For me, I mean, again, in my documentary world at all, I mean, it does depend on budget, logistics, size of your footprint, and also your physical kind of, I mean, your footprint, but your physical kind of presence. You know, sometimes I work on projects where you want to have a smaller camera for a number of reasons. So say, for instance, a C300 Mark II with like EF lensing. So I did have done a project recently with some toddlers, young 6-month-old boys that are having cochlear implants. So, you know, we're down on the ground a lot. You know, so having a smaller, lighter weight camera allows me to move a little quicker, be lower, shoot lower, you know, and I can do that all day. On the other hand, if it's shooting a larger project, maybe with a little bit bigger budget, and maybe you want to have a little bit more show your presence, sometimes this is actually a factor. That if you're doing an interview with Oliver Stone, you don't want to show up with a 5D or something, right? So, you know, so I shoot with the Amira a lot, 19-90, 85-300, the Fujinon Cabrios are some of my favorite because they're very flexible, very quick, and easy to use in the field, particularly for handheld verite. There's a trend now with people shooting verite with primes. I'm not one of those proponents, but
I am.
Oh, you are? Well, yeah. We can talk about that. But it's challenging for me, and that's a whole other podcast. But but it does. It depends certainly on budget and footprint, and but also again, it comes down with what tool is the right tool for you to tell the story accurately, you know. But
that's not the answer.
You weren't allowed to say that. Strike so that anyway, from the record.
So for me, the cameras that I use on RBG is I shot everything on the Mark II. Actually, I shot with two Mark IIs. Pretty much all the time.
The C300.
Yeah,
C300 Mark II.
Exactly, and we shot on primes exclusively, and that's not true.
Even your verite?
The verite I shot on the EF zooms because I had to be so fast. We would be granted 20 minutes, you know.
Wow.
That is, you have to have the flexibility of a right. zoom at that point.
Yeah, interviews know? On primes, but I'm saying for the verite, you were on it.
Well,
zoom,
for so her, yeah. I didn't do any prime verite. I do it for other shoots where I shoot on the 35
Neat.
Mostly.
Very cool.
You know, on the primes. And it means that when you're shooting on a prime handheld, it is you invade somebody's territory,
it's
you know, and
yeah.
they have to be able to ignore you, and you have to kind of test out if that works or not, or if it interferes. And sometimes you want to push your character,
sure.
you know, and it has a psychological force. And so I like that, you know, I like being felt that way, you know, and them feeling that they're on stage sometimes. But you need to see what the story, how it presents itself, and if there is an opportunity for it
sure.
or not. But I really love shooting on primes. And with the Price is Everything, we shot on the Amira, and I shoot on CineZooms. I love the Caprio as well, but I shot on the 17-120, and yeah, exactly the Canon. So I'm a fan of Canon lenses.
Can I just mention I did shoot the Cheer Up Baby on the Alexa High Speed with the Super Speeds Mark II. And I do like that setup. We actually then turned around. We did that for budget reasons, and we really liked the look of it and turned around and shot a couple of music videos with the exact same setup. So nice. It was kind of, I don't know.
Always be learning.
Always.
Well, any final words for aspiring DPs?
I have just one thought. Then I just mentioned this to somebody at a screening before, but I think just you know, somebody who's coming up who's sort of asking me advice. But I feel like in my many years of shooting, I feel like I've learned one thing is that you have to find like balance your work and life. There's work is not everything. You know, sort of align your priorities in a way that I often say. I like having a balance of jobs that feed my belly with jobs that feed my soul. So you take some that, you know, you're just paying the rent, and that's fine. There's other ones that I feel like I need to feed my soul. And so if you have that imbalance, you're either, you know, you're earning a ton of money and you're not really feeling good about yourself, or if you do the other and you're just, you know, you're doing, you,
not
you,
can't,
you
can't pay your bills.
You can't pay your bills. So there's always a sort of balance. So that's one thing. I just to have a good balance of jobs, and also be open to whatever's coming next. I mean, there's always every job that you take, there's always something you're going to learn, someone you're going to meet, some skill you're going to learn, some, you know, something you'll take from every job. So even if it's not like the perfect job, as long as you're kind of learning something new, I think it's worth taking. So
I totally agree. I actually go to every interview that is asked of me. I take every call, and even if I know my schedule is completely booked, because I believe it's a people business. And, you know, even if I can't be available for their job, I try to at least, you know, recommend somebody else. It's an opportunity for me to push those that I mentor. For people who are aspiring to become a cinematographer, you know, I think what helped me the most is to realize that you have to build a body of work before people will hire you. You have to have, you know, some films that you can edit together, you know, to a little reel, because you're an artist. You're going to be an artist. You're not just going to be a technician. And so you have to kind of develop that the way you see a story and how you represent that. And so I would recommend get your hands on whatever you can. Build up that muscle whenever you have an opportunity. Create a reel, create a website, and then, you know, align yourself with some mentors, and that's how you get going.
I feel like I would take a little bit of the business side of it, because I feel like that's talked about a little bit less, but get comfortable talking about yourself, get comfortable being your best advocate. And a lot of people say, how do I get an agent? I need an agent to like be the next thing. And I think that an agent does represent you. That's what you pay them to do. But if you can't represent yourself, if you can't show up at a film festival and introduce yourself and kind of do the networking stuff, or even when you're sitting on an airplane and talk to the person next to you, if you kind of can't promote yourself, and not just like on Instagram or whatever, but if you can't talk eloquently about yourself and your work, you're not going to get the next level job. You're not going to kind of keep moving up. You're going to continue getting the same thing. At least that's what I'm trying to tell myself every morning when I wake up.
I don't think that you need to talk eloquently. I mean, you know, I think you just have to talk. I think you just have to talk from
the group.
I think you just have to talk from the heart. I really, truly believe if you're authentic,
yes,
you know, to yourself and who you are, then it is not a matter of speaking eloquently. Because look, this is not my native tongue. You know, it's like I struggle with representing myself all the time, and I'm actually not really good at being in the spotlight. But I think if you are in small settings and take that opportunity, and even if at a party you're just meeting one person and you talk to them extensively, that is worth more money later down the line than trying to say hello to 100 people.
No, truly. I think that's what I mean, is like be comfortable with your own voice, because that's what you're selling as a cinematographer. You're not selling somebody who just pushes a button. You're selling your own perspective, your voice, your eye, and your mental capacity that goes with it. So being able to kind of have opinions, talk about things. I don't mean like eloquently in verse. I just mean put together a couple sentences. Have confidence in yourself. I think that's the biggest thing. I get questions from cinematographers of lots of ages and in various points saying I don't have confidence, or I don't, what they're amounting to is I'm not confident in my work or how to promote my work.
To young cinematographers, I always just tell them, like, you know, you can read as many articles as you want, you can listen to this podcast and take from it what you will, and it'll become part of like your brain's rhizome and internalize it. But then like throw it all away. Go fuck shit up. Do your own thing. Like, you don't need the best gear to make something that's cool and looks good. Like, don't let anything limit you. And just, like, I don't know. I want, like, the younger generation just, like, topple over, because everything's too homogenous. And we need, like, rebels who are going to, like, carve their own path.
And in terms of the gear, I totally agree with you. I think a lot of people can get very nerdy about the gear. But I think what gear represents to me is just a convenience. You know, if I have a daylight balanced light, that's the convenience. You know, it's not going to make the lighting look beautiful. That's what you do as a cinematographer. You know, you take that in.
Well, you heard it here, folks. Fuck shit up. It's I'm so in awe of each of you and your work, and it's been just a total thrill to have you. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. A true pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening. One of Ashley Connor's projects, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, went on to win Sundance's U.S. Dramatic Grand Jury Prize. and several of the other films mentioned here got picked up for distribution, so be on the lookout for them in 2018. Meanwhile, you can hear lots of other fascinating conversations on the art of filmmaking by finding the No Film School podcast in iTunes. Make sure to subscribe there or on your favorite podcast app so you can catch our Indie Film Weekly news show, which comes out every Thursday morning and fills you in on everything you might have missed when you were busy making films. Also, be sure to visit nofilmschool.com for useful new articles every single day. Meanwhile, stay in touch. You can reach me on Twitter @LizFilm, and we are on Twitter @NoFilmSchool. See you Thursday.